Welcome back to the Sports Politica podcast, the show that guides you through the dizzying world of sports, power, and politics. I'm your host, Karim Zidane, and today I wanted to delve into the recent developments we're seeing in the MMA space, including the fizzling out of the antitrust lawsuit, the collapse of Bloody Elbow, and the UFC's continued stranglehold on the market despite interest from Gulf state monarchies. To discuss these topics, I invited one of the most important voices in the MMA space, Luke Thomas, as a guest on this week's episode. I've known Luke for the better part of 10 years, and I've appeared on his various shows over the years to talk everything from Ramzan Kadyrov to Saudi Arabia's MMA investments. He is really the only voice I continue to listen to in the MMA space, and in many ways he keeps me sane. So I'm really delighted that he took the time to join us this week for what was a difficult and somewhat depressing conversation on the state of the industry. Now, without further ado, let's get started. Hey, Luke, how's it going? It's lovely to have you on Sports Politica. How are you?
I'm happy to be on, Kareem. Thank you for having me.
It's such a change of pace, let's say. I'm always the one being interviewed by you over the years, and it's really lovely to have you on the show, and thank you for taking the time. I was thinking about this point in terms of just how long we've been talking to each other and how many times you've had me on your show, and I thought to myself, when was the first time I ever reached out to Luke? And I went back through my email, and I had sent you, you probably won't remember this at all, and that's perfectly fine, but almost 10 years ago, Luke, like in December 2014, I emailed you saying, "Hey, Luke, how's it going? My name is so-and-so, and would you be able to give me some feedback on some of these articles I've been writing? I just joined Bloody Elbow." And you were so kind. You sent me such a long email telling me, "Hey, I've read this. This sounds really good. You need to find yourself a bit of a niche, etc. And you know, if you wanna write for big major outlets, you should be writing about 700, 800 words an article. And here's how you can tighten it up." And I was thinking about that now, like, oh my goodness, so much has changed in 10 years. And it was just a nice memory to see just how, you know, how kind you were to me when I was a nobody, basically, then. And it influenced me a lot in terms of how I've approached the sport in general. When people reach out for advice, etc., I'm always open to responding via email. So yeah, that was just a bit of a story I wanted to get started with. I've known you for a while, and it's been an interesting process, and a lot has changed.
Well, so the roles have reversed, because I feel like I've learned a lot from you over the years as well. So I'm glad we could be mutually beneficial to one another as time has gone on.
Certainly so. And well, since we're on this to an extent, and I mentioned Bloody Elbow, let's start there. Bloody Elbow is unfortunately no more, and you know, I hadn't been a part of the site for. I was only around for the first couple of months that they went independent, and then I moved on and did my own thing. But I was really rooting for them. I really, really was. And you were one of the people who had a lot to say once, you know, Bloody Elbow was no more. What do you think this really means? You've had some time now. It's been about a month since this happened. What do you think this means for the overall landscape of the sport, the loss of Bloody Elbow?
Well, the kind of funny thing that happened was... I mean, you could say everything happens in threes, but everything happened sort of concurrently, where Bloody Elbow eventually dissolved. The owner sold the site, and there have been, you know, people have gone to other places. They're trying to, you know, get their Substack going, but the site itself is no more. And then there was the class action settlement, which was, I think, a major news story in any kind of direction that happened like in short order within a month, I think, of the two events. And then this last week, it was announced that Silver Lake Private Equity was going to take Endeavor back private. And this is all over the years on the back of various commissions, Florida, Nevada, no longer making pay public. I could sort of go on down the list. It just felt to me like if there was ever going to be any kind of age of accountability in the sport, at least for now, the window is closed. I think that period in the sport where there were still a lot of – there was consolidation happening in the market, right? There's always this boom when a new product or idea launches, there's this massive interest in it. There is a lot of firms competing, and then there's eventually over time consolidation. And that consolidation was happening in real time, but there was also, you know, a number of these challenges to make sure there was various workplace protections or various ideas promoted. It feels like all of that has closed. And maybe that is wrong. Maybe we will see in short order that I have miscalculated it. I cannot in any way predict the future other than to say, I mean, the MMA industry just is the UFC at this point. There really isn't much beyond that. The regulators have been brought to heel. Their anti-doping program is in-house. They make money. They don't even know what to do with, you know, the fighters have no real ability to compete for proper wages. They don't seem to care, which is really another kind of interesting dimension to it. So when I look at it in concert with the other events, it just feels to me like MMA is a very unregulated space. Mm-hmm. And for the foreseeable future, it's going to stay that way. You know, unfortunate.
You talk about this consolidation, and is this something that coincides with Endeavor's takeover of the and buyout of the UFC? Is this Ari Emanuel's long-term doing, basically? Because we don't talk, I think we don't talk enough about him specifically, his influence, his power as this Hollywood mogul, and really this ruthless businessman as well. What influence do you think he's playing in all these changes that we're seeing real time right now?
Well, definitely the desire to go public initially, I think, was his brainchild, which I think mm-hmm. he had admitted to. And so I think obviously their initial attempt to get the IPO going failed. The secondary one succeeded. And, you know, it hasn't necessarily been great for them altogether. I think going private again and reducing any kind of financial transparency that existed. Some TKO Holdings will remain public, mm-hmm. but in general, obviously Endeavor will lose it. I mean, I think he's been a big driver of that, but and I think you're right, actually, like the extent to which his role is examined in the UFC's development is somewhat to a degree unknown mm-hmm. by outsiders and to a degree certainly undercovered. I'm sure those two factors are related. But to be honest with you, like if you go back to the lawsuit and you see what some of the plaintiffs, though, that would be the fighters in those cases were arguing. And then I think had good evidence for was that the UFC, for example, bought out Pride and purposely didn't do due diligence so that the organization would basically crumble and they could reduce the choices in the marketplace for any fighter to go to. That is manifestly anti-competitive behavior. Buying out Strikeforce is not the same kind of thing, but it's a similar kind of process. And so, you know, the consolidation had been happening for quite some time. I'm very, very influenced by, I'm sure you're familiar with him. I've been very influenced by some of the teachings of Tim Wu, mm-hmm. who is basically a telecom law. He briefly worked in the Biden administration in consumer protection, but as a telecom lawyer and as a professor at Columbia University, he has several books, one of which is called The Master Switch. And in it, he traces basically the advent of television, the advent of radio and these new technologies. And it's the same process over and over. There's this boom of innovation. There's a bunch of firms competing. It's really interesting. And then slowly over time, one to two firms basically take over. Then regulation comes in, breaks it up, and you go on from there. And he traces it on all these different technologies. MMA is not a technology, but it is a new product. It is a new sport. It is a new area that is unregulated in many ways compared to its combat sports brethren. And I see a similar kind. I mean, I don't want to be too closely associated with, I'm sure there are very meaningful differences between the growth of telecom and the growth of a sport. But nevertheless, some of the broad strokes of the market dynamics have been very, very similar. And so to me, the Ari Emanuel question, as I stated earlier, I think is a very relevant one. But in fairness to the broader picture, that there was a lot of consolidation happening before he ever got there.
This Ari Emanuel stuff is particularly strange to me because I think a lot of what we're seeing now that TKO is TKO and it's the UFC and the WWE, I'm trying to find the similarities in how they have moved those two businesses forward. We think of the WWE, and I really am not going to take up your time with too many wrestling questions, but I do think this one is connected to an extent in that what the WWE has been doing the past few years is focusing on its media rights deals. There's been a lot less of those house shows. They've been focusing a lot. Basically, whoever attends these events now is not really relevant to their overall business. Their money and their valuation has increased and skyrocketed based on what they've been able to get in terms of media rights. And a lot of that has come from the people who the WWE has hired and who run them now, from Nick Khan to Ari Emanuel, etc. Is this the direction that the UFC is going in as well? And I find if that is the case, doesn't that go against the the benefits of the consumer overall. I mean, basically, if your focus now is just on the media rights, then and you don't need the fans' money, say, then is this going to be a sport favoring the fan at all at this point? This applies to both, really, the wrestling yes. and to mixed martial arts.
I would be speaking out of turn if I spoke to any of the specificities of the dynamics in pro wrestling, but
fair enough.
but I certainly am aware of the media rights prioritization changing within the company, and certainly with the UFC as well. I mean, I'll keep it there just so I can make a great, mm-hmm. I think a more helpful example, which would be, so for folks who may not know, a third of the UFC does 40 plus shows a year, approximately one pay-per-view a month. Hard to say exactly how many fight nights, which is a lower tiered show, they take on the road, but you know, let's say one, one every other month, it feels like, but the vast majority, one third of all of their shows take place in their Apex facility. And these are cards that they would very much struggle to sell tickets to if they were not in that facility. There are sort of two competing thoughts about why they exist. One of which is that they have promised a certain amount of shows to fulfill their ESPN contract, which goes to the media rights fees. As long as they meet the quota of the number of shows, then they're going to get a gigantic check. John Nash was talking about this. It makes the business less lumpy. They used to be heavily reliant on pay-per-view. Pay-per-view is still an important driver, but significantly less so in this new era. And it's like you watch these Apex shows, that's a dead atmosphere. Sometimes friends and family are in attendance, and certainly you can get good fights on occasion, or relevant fights. It's not to say that they're utterly absent, but what it basically feels like when you watch the pay-per-view or the fight nights on the road and then compare it to an Apex show, it just feels like roster overflow. It feels like people who would not be, for the most part, in the UFC, other than they have to scale as far out as they can in order to meet these demands for the contracted revenue from the media rights that they now have prioritized in a way that they never did before. It's not fan service. Mm-hmm. You can't actually argue it's fan service. And then I know folks get back to it and they always say, well, if you don't like it, don't watch. And it's, of course, that's always going to be true. But one more time, the MMA industry is the UFC. Like, you can't really, you cannot watch, but it's not really possible if you're an MMA fan to remain an MMA fan and then boycott the UFC in any kind of significant way that they can feel it. And I don't know that the full dynamics of WWE relative to AEW, which I'm guessing is the number two mm-hmm. in that industry. MMA doesn't really have any, I know PFL kind of fancies itself that way, but it's really not true. But you can't really meaningfully push back on them. And especially now that they're driving scarcity to their pay-per-view shows, because then when they go on the road, then it is a big deal. This is what happens when, like, if there was another firm that had a significant amount of interest in the market and was taking their show on the road, you would see that the UFC would not be able to get away with this. And in fact, they've kind of just, you know, punted on being a regular presence in Europe. And what has happened as a result, KSW, massive shows. Octagon is going to do 55,000 in Frankfurt coming up here in a little while. Certainly you've seen what PFL and Bellator, mm-hmm. two struggling brands, have done over there, because there's just a total absence of them. So it does give them a bit of a competitive advantage in some of those places. I'm merely pointing out stateside, you know, you just can't really push back. It has insulated them. And I don't, again, this idea that this is what benefits consumers. You mentioned, you talked about Ari Emanuel. I think one thing that's just anyone in his role would have done, such that you can call it that, they own the industry. There's nothing left to conquer. You can raise the market in other places, but wherever they've been, they own it. And so the only thing that's really left is to find ways to extract value from the existing fan base or the market that's there. You can't really meaningfully do anything new. And so I think you're seeing the product rearranged in ways to accommodate some of those business ends.
You've touched on a lot of really interesting things there, Luke. And I'm going to try and lay out these questions in an order where we can move forward organically here. You mentioned the PFL and not seeing it as a legitimate number two at all. This includes with the investment from Saudi Arabia. Do you think, despite, say, Saudi Arabia really does want to, for some reason or other, take MMA extremely seriously in comparison to its other sports, does that not have some sort of effect in terms of competition, do you think? Or is the UFC so cemented that nothing short of a full buyout or something like that could change things?
I would have two responses to that. The first is that the answer to the question is, does the Saudi investment matter? My answer is going to be not really.
Okay.
I'm not going to say it's irrelevant. Like, if the Saudis are really committed to the PFL, they obviously have pockets that could prop them up for years to come. And in that sense, it is relevant. But if we're talking about competing with the UFC, no, it's not really relevant for two reasons. One, the UFC also does business with the Saudis. It's not one or the other. And the UFC has existing relationship with the Emirates as well. You know, these are people who are doing business in relatively similar-ish circles. Okay, so that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I would say is, yes, again, the PFL could be propped up monetarily for some time. That is true. But the reality is, if you have, I'm just going to say at this point, 90% of the best talent, and you categorically refuse to allow your fighters to face them in any kind of co-promotion, and then on top of it, you have forbidden them from ever engaging in any kind of class action lawsuit. That's now a condition to sign. And then on top of it, more to the point, you have added tolling provisions or whatever, such that there isn't a lot of freedom of movement over the course of an athlete's life, then you're not going to get the meaningful crossover you need for the PFL roster to ever be relevant. I mean, this is what I mean. Mm-hmm. I have watched everyone try and say, we don't need our fighters to fight the UFC fighters. We're going to build our own rosters, and we're going to put it on big networks, and we're going to make it exciting, and we're just going to have our own universe. That does not work. It does not work. I have watched innumerable promotions try this with big dollars, not Saudi dollars, but, you know, hundreds of millions, certainly not a small investment. And every single time it fails, because the public at any given time in combat sports history will look at a certain series of champions or organizational fighters as the legitimate ones. And unless there is crossover between that and any kind of new crop, there's no way for the new crop to meaningfully capture attention. And so, you know, the PFL doesn't have a fan base. I don't know how you win with that. How do you win in a circumstance like that? So they do have good fighters. They do put on good fights. But is the Saudi thing going to be a difference maker? I tend to think not long term.
Do we not think, for instance, you do have an extremely important point here about the brands, and that is very, very difficult to challenge someone with the brand power of the UFC, really. That's where all the fans are. I mean, some people even go by UFC rather than MMA. I mean, when the brand is known as the sport itself, you're in trouble if you're trying to compete. But I'm still thinking of this Francis Ngannou situation here, and I'm wondering to myself, well, if enough fighters see Francis Ngannou being showered with sort of this incredible paydays, really, to compete in Saudi Arabia, and this attention and these opportunities that he's getting, and the glitz and glamour of the showcases taking place in Saudi Arabia versus sort of the, you know, I mean, how do we even describe these apex events rather than, you know, this just mind numbing, really, in so many ways. You look at that contrast, and is that not something that's appealing to some fighters? A lot of these people are showmen at the end of the day. Do they not want to perform under different circumstances? Is that not something that makes at least worthwhile for them to try and see if they can wait out their contract? Is that not really something you believe will be the case?
Not really. I would. Yeah. I mean, again, there might be circumstances where individual cases where that is one. I mean, Francis is a unique guy in a lot of different ways, and I think has a certain self-belief and vision that is quite rare, even among guys who all believe they're going to win the lottery, right? Like, anyone who prize fights for a living basically feels like, oh, everyone else didn't win the lottery, but I'm gonna. And sometimes they're right, but very rarely. Anyway, the fighters are not effective stewards of their own protection. Just manifestly, they trust totally incapable, incompetent, and otherwise morally questionable people to help manage their affairs and or careers. You know, they often reject sound financial advice in any number of different directions. And again, I don't want to paint a brush that this is all the case, but it happens enough where you cannot ignore it as a relevant factor. And so, you know, they and again, there's other reasons why they wouldn't get involved, but they've tried unionization. It failed. They tried the class action lawsuit. They made a hell of an effort, but ultimately, in terms of changing the industry, it failed in that regard. And any other number of things you bring up, they actually get hostile to it. So, like, they're just not strong stewards of their own protection. I think that would be kind of one way I would look at it. The other one is the reality of the contracts. And by the way, we should be very clear about this. You know, there's a lot of focus on UFC contracts for a very good reason. They're the dominant force by a million miles. But if you actually looked at like ONE contracts or PFL contracts, they're as bad, if not worse. ONE in particular is worse. There's no question about it. So very this is hard. I mean, this is just like, this is just a, I mean, we should just say this out loud. The MMA industry as it's currently constructed does not work but for exploitation. It doesn't work. If you would, you have to fundamentally change how business is conducted. If you change in any kind of way the protections for the athletes, like it would just be radically transforming. I mean, I'm not using that word lightly. It would be transforming. Everything runs off of the fact that they don't have a lot of leverage, and when they do, they don't exercise it. So the second part I would say is these contracts, you know, you mentioned, oh, wouldn't they be excited? And so, for example, there's a case like Derek Lewis, who came up at the end of his contract and then he got re-signed. You know, he came up in a main event. Folks were kind of like, how did he end up there? I don't know. I have an idea how he ended up there. He had a chance to go fight Ngannou and didn't, and they put him in bigger slots. Maybe that plays a role. Maybe it doesn't. I'm sure that they made it worth his while to some extent anyway not to go. They've got the pockets to do that when they want to. But more to the point, there's just not going to be many guys over the course of Francis's career time in PFL that are even going to come up for eligibility because of how many provisions where it's not the day you sign a contract. Mm-hmm. It's actually your first fight. If you get suspended, which can happen, if you even get a cut in a fight that you win, you can be medically suspended. They're going to add on all these tolling provisions. And so between the fact that most of these fighters don't seem very interested in protecting their own career interests, and then on top of it, even if they wanted to, it'd be very difficult. This is what I mean about, like, you literally can't compete with the UFC without changes to the industry. It's not possible, even with Saudi money.
So the UFC is in a position of strength and consolidation it's never been in before. It's surpassing even its own expectations. Do we see, with this type of valuation that it continues to gain, especially when its partnership or its merger with the WWE for TKO, do we eventually see Ari try to sell the UFC? Is that just too valuable overall as a part of Endeavor, even as a private entity, for them to attempt to sell it off? Because I can make a case for either the UAE or Saudi to be interested, but I'd like your thoughts on this.
Now, that's an interesting one. I actually do think they would sell it potentially if they got a really significant high value offer, which, to your point, Saudis, UAE, they certainly have the cash for that if they wanted to. What that would look like is, well, TKO, which would include WWE, would be valued around somewhere around $20 billion. Imagine they offered $20 billion just for the UFC, and then you got to keep WWE. Would they make a deal like that? Maybe they would. You know, maybe they would. Hard to say. But that's – I'll let you go here in just a second. But, like, of any scenario where they would sell, I don't think it's likely they sell, but in any scenario where they would, that one for sure seems to me the most likely. What were you going to say?
I was going to agree with you. That makes a lot of sense, because I was thinking in my head, well, a sale as TKO doesn't quite make sense, because if I really break it down between the UAE and Saudi, Saudi is much more interested in the WWE personally. I can see them hosting a WrestleMania in the next couple of years. That I firmly believe. I don't think they're as invested overall in MMA. I don't see it as part of their identity the way I see it in the UAE. The UAE has truly built a significant portion of its sports-related soft power on the backing of combat sports, starting with jiu-jitsu, which is truly one of the most powerful and influential countries when it comes to jiu-jitsu, if not the most. And its long-standing history with the UFC and how it's implemented this sort of combat sports narratives into its public life. Its jiu-jitsu is its national sport. It's practiced in the military and in police forces. This is significant for the UAE. I think them owning the UFC is a significant soft power move. It's sort of in the, for them, like owning Manchester City. I don't think it matters as much to Saudi Arabia, to be honest with you. So what you're saying, the way you've broken it down, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, that is certainly true. And we've already seen, so for example, let's back up a step. I mean, years ago, you'll recall this, Kareem, Flash Entertainment, mm-hmm. which is essentially, you know, part of the UAE, they own 10% of the UFC. Now, they eventually sold it back and whatever. But we've already been through a world where a subsection of the UFC was already owned basically by the Emirates, smaller one, obviously. Mm-hmm. But why couldn't they produce another situation like that where they own 51%, not the entire thing, or, mm-hmm. you know, some other kind of controlling share? That is, I think, certainly on the table. And to your point, ADCC is the most popular grappling event, not including the Olympics, but certainly on the submission grappling side, jiu-jitsu, sambo, whatever. ADCC, they're going to be in the T-Mobile Arena this year for 2 days. They might be sold out both of those days. Now, that's partly the leadership of the guy who currently runs the organization and some of his broader ambitions, mm-hmm. but it ties it back to what you're discussing about what their role could be. And also, if you go back to the PFL deal with Saudi Arabia, it's for $100 million. Again, not a pittance. But in the broader scope of what they might need, that's not enough to compete with UFC. It's not even close, actually. So I could see it breaking up that way. But I forgot what I was going to say about the rest of the stuff. But yeah, that's where I was.
Legitimately, I don't quite understand Saudi's role in all of this in terms of mixed martial arts. See, they were smart when it came to boxing. I think about this a lot now, and I think about Turki Sheikh building this sort of cult of personality where he's now known as His Excellency to everybody from boxing media to its, you know, to its most popular fighters. It's just insanity is what we're witnessing right now. It's absurdity. But they infiltrated a sport that was extremely vulnerable, where its top athletes refused to come together for agreements, where its promoters were happier just bickering than actually giving good fights. And they paid everyone enough where they sat them down and said, you're going to compete and you're going to have these fights. And now the fans are delighted. Their fans are actually celebrating Saudi's investment in boxing. I see it time and time again with articles and on the forums. That's a smart investment for Saudi Arabia. I believe that they're not going to back away from boxing. I just don't understand what they intend to gain from the UFC. Or is it just a matter of saying we want our hands in everything? Sure, you can have a fight night. You can technically keep that one event partnership with the UFC every year from now on. But what's the point? The UAE, your rival, has a bigger relationship with the UFC. What advantages do you have by even taking over the sport? Say you buy the UFC. What's the point of it for you? Taking on this new class of just exploited fighters, how is that benefiting your brand internationally? Maybe you have a different idea here, but I just have never understood personally Saudi's massive interest in mixed martial arts.
So I think right now they're in the kicking the tire stage, mm-hmm. which is why I think you're sort of detecting what's working for them and what's not. I mean, we should back up a step. Like, what they've done, and we got to be careful too, because they haven't done, for example, the Saudi Arabians have not done a Canelo fight. They've not done mm-hmm. a Tank Davis fight. They've not mm-hmm. done a Chocolatito fight. They've done all basic
heavyweights.
Now, that's going to be a little bit different because you've got Beterbiev and Bivol coming up. But this is what I mean. They basically went to a sport, to your point, that was tribalistic, that no one wanted to work together. And with an infusion of cash, at least at heavyweight, the sport was transformed. Again, I'm going to use that word very explicitly, to the point where it's actually changing how people in boxing take the sport. I'll give you a perfect example. Deontay Wilder had a surprising but altogether pretty bad loss against Joseph Parker, and he's right back at it again against Zhile Zhang, this gigantic Chinese fighter. And I saw people commenting, see what, because they made the fights in short order. Like, they had one fight, didn't go well. 6 months later, they got a booking ready to go, which most of the time after there's a big fight in boxing, you don't know when that guy's going to mm-hmm. be back. And the fans were like, dude, this is what happens when the fighters take fights more regularly. You don't even worry about their last loss. And it actually, like, that's true. That's 1,000% true, that if these guys stay active, it changes your entire perception of how things are going, what matters to you, what doesn't, how much you hang on a defeat, how much you cling to a win. It just makes it like it just keeps coming in. You just feel great about the whole process. Dude, the Saudis have done all of that. Whatever else everyone wants to say about them, I'm just talking about the impact mm-hmm. in the sport. It has been transformational. So to your point, does doing business with the UFC do that? Remains to be seen. Remains to be seen exactly. Though they're going to have a good card coming up here, actually a very good card coming up here with Robert Whittaker and obviously Khamzat Chimaev. But the joy that they brought to boxing fans, I don't know if they've got the same ability to do that for everyone else, as long as the UFC is the one essentially still in control of the product.
Yeah, you know, that Saudi card's an interesting example because clearly I had a feeling this was going to be the case, that if the UFC was going to go with a fight night card, they weren't going to just be able to take any of their usual fight night cards, that Saudi was going to expect something just a step above. And I think they got that step above after the fight was the event was sort of delayed and rescheduled for June. I still don't see this relationship being what's meant to be. I think the UFC is destined to be with the United Arab Emirates. That's my view on this. But I think, again, of just that UFC Saudi card and the fact that Khamzat Chimaev is on that card, I've been given very, very good information that I happen to trust here, that Khamzat Chimaev is basically not able to get back into the United States, at least for the foreseeable future, due to visa issues, that a lot of which have to do with Ramzan Kadyrov, some of which have to do with potentially his own criminal record in Sweden. This is more stuff that I'm trying to figure out and report on as we go along. It's very difficult to get information from the United States about people being on visa banned entry lists, etc. But doing the best I can there. But this is a long-winded way of saying we're still seeing examples of Ramzan Kadyrov popping up in the sport. We're still seeing the exploitation of fighters. None of this seems to matter as much anymore with the downfall of independent outlets like Bloody Elbow, etc. Luke, do you think the UFC is just won at this point? Is there any point to what people like me do, really? Like, I mean, I've expanded into a wide range of sports in general, and I cover a lot of different things. But I can't help but come back to MMA every once in a while. Maybe I'm just a masochist, but is there really any point to this anymore? You talked about accountability earlier. We could not be in any less of an age of accountability now than ever before, I think. What's the point? The UFC seems to have won here.
So let me back up one step about like what Saudi Arabia might be able to get from UFC. Again, it's sort of, you know, if they can host the World Cup, then this changes, you know, this is not a relevant point. But that card in Saudi Arabia, it is airing on ABC. It is airing on ABC here in the United States. It's not a pay-per-view. That is going to be a daytime card on a big mainstream network. And they're, you know, obviously they're, I think the Saudis are going to be pleased with the fact that it's airing in that way. It's not behind some paywall. Mm-hmm. They're going to treat Saudi Arabia like they would if they were in Milwaukee or Los Angeles or anything else. And I think obviously that's what the Saudis want. So they do get something out of that. But again, if they get the World Cup, then they're going to get that in every world capital that there is.
Yeah.
Is there a point? I don't know anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I'm not sure what to say. I have thought about this a lot. I have lost a lot of sleep over it too.
So have I. I had to ask this. I'm sorry. It's a heavy question, I know, but I know if anybody was going to be feeling a similar way, it was you, so I had to ask.
I mean, listen, I'll say this. It's not that it's forever not relevant. Mm-hmm. Legal minds have noted that if another promoter wanted to sue UFC for anti-competitive practices, granted, you'd have to start a very long legal process, but that is still an avenue where some kind of change potentially could happen as a result, or there's always legislation that could be passed at any point. And I think to the extent an event like that happens, where there is a real big lawsuit or there is some kind of regulatory pressure, which, by the way, often happens with media pressure, and there is no media pressure, but let's just say that there was, or whatever the case, somebody in Congress really wanted to take that up. Obviously, I think there would be an enormous importance in covering that. But day to day, week to week, month to month, I don't know anymore. And I'll tell you, like, you look at the rise of influencers as a media force. They're not encumbered in any way by journalistic norms. The audience doesn't seem to care that they don't. In fact, it only, like, you know, hey, this person has said horrible shit and, you know, any number of other problems. We're just going to ignore that. We're going to treat them like an absolutely normal person. And that interview will do significantly better. They don't have to talk to you anymore. Now this kind of character, whereas before the media had a bit of a monopoly on who had a voice. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of folks are going to say loosening the grip on that monopoly is a good thing, which there is certainly a lot to be said for that. I don't disagree, but if journalistic practices, okay, if journalism at the end of the day, your ability to like really as a way to feed yourself, as a way to pay your bills, if ultimately that depends on clicks and then journalistic practices, not always, but in many cases, impact your ability to do that, It's a bleak fucking future, man. It's a bleak future, at least for right now. So I've given this a lot of thought. I don't know what the right answer is. The dust is still kind of settling, and I don't think we really know. But it certainly seems like, for example, just on the issue of fighter pay, I don't know what else I'm supposed to say about it at this point. I've given this story damn near more than a decade, certainly much more than a decade of my time. And it ended up here. And the fighters themselves don't seem to care. I don't know what else I can even, even if I wanted to keep talking about it, I don't even know what else to say about it anymore. So it's part of a larger process of the crumbling of media and what that means for broader society. And, it's part of a story where, like, you know, people always ask me, hey, did you see so-and-so's documentary about a famous person? And then I'll look and see, was that famous person also an executive producer? It's like, we just live in a world now where the powerful have more ability to, the audience has less resistance to, mm-hmm. powerful people telling their own stories in the way that they want to, even amidst total fabrications, misleading statements, complete omission of fact. If people don't care and that does well, what are you supposed to do? I don't know.
So where do you find joy in mixed martial arts now? Is it MK, Morning Combat? Is it with Brian Campbell? Is that, like, what are you doing to stay sane in the space now?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really know. I'm trying to figure out exactly what the next 5 years of my life looks like. And some of that is coming into focus, but not all of it yet, because obviously a lot of things are still in my particular situation in transition. So there's that. I mean, first of all, MK is great because we cover boxing as well. So it's mm-hmm. we're not entirely reliant on MMA for that reason. I think, in fact, the next fight we're going to go to will be Canelo's fight against Jaime Munguia, which I'm looking forward to. Mm-hmm. The fights themselves still bring me great joy. Breaking them down and understanding them and trying to learn more has been my favorite thing to do for a very long time. I still love the aftermath of a fight and talking about what happened. So all of those things, the things that I've always liked, those things I also liked, but the joy of, you know, being part of a smaller, a little engine that could community, that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that part is totally gone. So, I think in going forward, it's hard to say going forward, but for the time being and what has been true for a long time, focusing most of my efforts, on the joy of the fights themselves and kind of leaving it there, I think is probably what I'll be doing for a little while.
Luke, thank you so much for coming on the show and for having this very frank discussion with me. I mean, I could heap praise on you day and night. You're one of the reasons I have been able to remain sane and, like, covering this sport and listening to you over the years, whether it be in the live chat, whether it be on Morning Combat, whether it be, you know, whatever it was before that on MMA Fighting as well, and the MMA Hour and all that. It's been a joy. It's been a pleasure. And I hope to continue seeing you in this space, because I can't imagine what mixed martial arts looks like without Luke Thomas.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very kind. And again, I'll say one more time, I learned a lot from you as well. Yeah, I'll be around. I mean, I'm MK every Monday, all that good stuff. And we're going to be traveling to fights, and I'm looking forward to, you know, all the big fights this year for sure. But to put it mildly, strange times indeed.
Absolutely. Hope to have this discussion again sometime in the future, and maybe on a better note then.
For sure.
Until then, take care, Luke. Thank you so much.